It's How to Be Amazing from PRX. I'm Michael Ian Black.
I came out of the womb in like a top hat and tap shoes. I mean, I really did not have a choice.
My guest today spent the first two decades of her career hustling and jiving her way through show business. To anyone who's attempted to make a living as an actor, hers was a familiar story.
There were periods of time where I didn't work and I was completely broke and would miraculously get an episode of Murder, She Wrote or something at the last second and be able to pay my rent.
That is, until something amazing happened.
Hey, bitches, let's get this lady lovin' started.
At age 39, Megan Mullally landed the role of Karen Delaney St. Croix Pupil Finster Walker.
Don't call me by my real name. Call me by my alias, Anastasia Beaverhausen.
The boozy, pill-popping assistant to Grace Adler on the iconic television series Will and Grace. The show ran for 8 seasons and catapulted Megan Mullally into stardom. Since then, she's hosted her own talk show, starred in shows like Children's Hospital and 30 Rock, and still finds time to perform with her band, Nancy and Beth, in which no one is named Nancy or Beth. But I was especially excited to talk to Megan because of her experience on both sides of celebrity. Her down-to-earth perspective on fame is informed by her late arrival to stardom and by her father's struggle with his own acting career, which never quite got off the ground. On today's show, I'll talk to Megan about her work, her life, and the meaning of fame. And then we'll make out a little. Megan Mullally, welcome to How to Be Amazing.
Thanks for having me, Michael Ian Black.
Well, I'm so happy you're here.
Well, I'm happy to be here because I'm a big fan of yours.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that very much. I don't believe it, but I thank you. and I of you. And I want to start today with Will and Grace, and can you kind of set the scene for us a little bit in terms of the culture of the country, where we were in 1998 when that show premiered, and what your expectations for the show were?
Well, I had said to my agent not too long before Will and Grace, from a payphone in the parking lot of a Bed Bath & Beyond, I had told him that I was no longer auditioning for sitcoms because I felt like I had definitely played that thread completely out. I had done many, many pilots that didn't go anywhere, that either didn't get picked up or went for 7 episodes or 13. And I said, look, this is obviously not working. He said, I strongly disagree. I said, well, you can't change my mind. And then I didn't have any money and couldn't pay my rent. And I was like, okay, I'm not auditioning for sitcoms. So I auditioned for that show, and I didn't have, having been through that process so many times, I really didn't have any expectations that it would go anywhere. The fact that it had 2 gay characters was interesting, but I didn't take the full impact of that really in that moment. There were no shows on television. The last show that it had a gay character was Soap, where Billy Crystal had a supporting role and he played a gay guy. And that was in,
like, 78, 79,
78,
something
yeah,
like
that's
that.
Exactly what I was going to say.
So Ellen hadn't come out on her sitcom
at
this point?
No, Ellen had. Yeah, that's right. You're right. I'm forgetting that. So Ellen had actually, by coming out, had laid a lot of pipe for us to be successful. But I
don't talk about gay sitcoms and laying pipe simultaneously. Let's just keep it above board, please.
I'm so sorry. I lost myself for a second. but yeah, I feel like that helped us a lot because...
Although ironically, when she came out, that was sort of the beginning of the end of her show.
Well, it absolutely was. I think, you know, here's what happened with that. She had established herself as this blue-eyed blonde, like, you know, America's sweetheart who's funny and cute and is this girl on the sitcom. And then when she came out as a lesbian on the show, I mean, it was done really well, but it instantly politicized the entire thing. So you can't – then the following week, the episode can't just be about, you know, crazy hijinks at a bowling alley. You know, you have to address the fact that she's come out as a gay woman. So I think that the key to Will and Grace not getting that kind of flack – was that was just another attribute of many. You know, Will worked as a lawyer and he likes to cook and he's gay and he's this and he's that, you know, and it was never politicized, you know. It was just another element of their personality,
although, of course,
their lives.
In just being, it was political. I mean, the show itself, just by nature of its existence,
but
was political.
Slipped under the radar somehow, because also the gay bashing was built into the show. I mean, the characters, you know, Will and Jack would gay bash each other constantly. So if you're, inclined to, think that way, then the work is done for you.
Right. And was there a moment when you felt your life change in there, or was it so kind of gradual that it felt more natural?
It didn't feel unnatural, but it also didn't feel natural. Like, I remember the very first time I was in, I went to some little gift shop to buy somebody a birthday present, and this couple was in there, and they were staring at me, and I was like, what the fuck is going on? What's going on? Like, I couldn't put it together, and then I finally realized that they were recognizing me. It took me a long time to get used to being recognized.
Do you like being famous now?
No.
That's a succinct answer. Very succinct answer.
It's fine. It's okay. It's great in that it can open some doors. I don't have to go out and pound the pavement to get jobs. Like, I'll get offered things, which is fantastic. And so in that regard, it's great. But, there's nothing other than that, which I guess is a really big thing.
Well, it is. If you're in this business, I think a lot of people look at fame as desirable on its own merits. And my sense of it is that it's not really.
No, it's not. It's definitely not. As a matter of fact, there are things about it that are, really a bummer. But I don't understand the, paparazzi era mentality of, you got into this business, so you're asking for it. Well, no. I mean, I got it. I didn't get into the business to have my photographers jump out and take my picture at the
airport.
Well,
then you're in it for the wrong reason, sister.
I know. I did it because I came out of the womb in like a top hat and tap shoes. I mean, I really did not have a choice.
Well, your dad was an actor. Carter Mullaly Jr.
Yes.
And it seems like he went out to L.A. to become an actor. He had you there, right?
Yes, I was born in Los Angeles.
And then it didn't pan out. And he returned to is Oklahoma his home state?
Yes, my father is from Oklahoma City, and my mother's from Tulsa, and I grew up in Oklahoma City.
I want to talk about your dad's experience in L.A. trying to become an actor. What was that like for him?
Well, my father grew up in Oklahoma City and was kind of an atypical personality for that part of the country, especially at that time, because he was very extravagantly, over the top and sort of flamboyant and funny, and he was theatrical, and most people there kind of aren't. And so he ultimately went out to Los Angeles, and he didn't ever get his big break. And ultimately, I think he couldn't handle the rejection, and he and my mom moved us back to Oklahoma, and he continued to do some things around that area, like dinner theater and things in Dallas and Fort Worth and some things in Oklahoma, and that was it.
So when you said, I want to be an actress, what was his reaction?
Well, he said, oh, no, it's too hard. But my mother was very encouraging. I mean, my father was encouraging also in his own way. But I remember the very first thing he said was that. And I feel like it didn't matter, really, what anybody said, because it was really all I was an only child. And when I was 3 years old, I was over at my grandparents' house, and they were entertaining. My parents were there, and my aunt and uncle. And I was upstairs, and I really had been extremely quiet up until this point. I barely ever spoke, and I was just very shy and never did anything wrong. And I was upstairs, and I thought, well, it's time. And I mean, I remember this like it was yesterday, and I don't know what
led up. And you were three?
I was three, and I don't know what led up to it. I have no memory of that. I just remember this whole thing, like, with crystal clarity. And I was upstairs, and there was and I thought, well, I guess I should zhuzh myself up a little. And there was a round banister that led down the stairs. And I was a big fan of Bozo the Clown at the time, so I thought, well, I'll roll my hair on the banister like Bozo. And so I wrapped, you know, a big hank of hair around the banister and held it there for a few seconds and let it go, and it just fell back down. I was like, well, I'm just going to have to make do with whatever is happening right now. And so I raced down the stairs, and my, you know, these four couples, my grandparents and my aunt and uncle and the other couple and my parents, were sitting in the living room, and the dining room happened to be up, like, two or three shallow steps. And so there was, in effect, a proscenium arch. And I ran to the middle of this space at the top of these little stairs, and I threw my arms out to the side, and I yelled out, "Ladies and gentlemen, introducing the world's greatest clown." And then I proceeded to go into my act, which I realized suddenly had not put any thought into whatsoever. So I think my act was pretty thin, but everybody present was just, they were floored, because I really had not made a peep. I mean, I had spoken some words, but I was not in any way an
expert. You just had a sense at three, well, it's time. Here we go.
Yeah.
Time to begin this journey.
And then I've been trying to slam that door shut ever since, to no avail.
What are your feelings now? I don't quite know how to phrase this, but how do you feel about having had so much success in this business when you think about your dad and his dreams? Is there any sort of emotional freight that goes with that?
Well, I don't think it's a coincidence that I did not become successful until after my dad passed away. And I think the first thing that I did, my father died in 1992, and the first thing that I did that really, I think, where people sort of sat up and took any kind of notice was I did How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying on Broadway with Matthew Broderick, and I played the lead role opposite him. And that was the first time that people were like, who's this girl? You know, even though I'd been, as I said, I'd been sort of swirling around working. And my father had actually briefly moved out to Los Angeles to take another stab at it. And shortly after he moved out there, he got an apartment like a block away from mine. It was a little weird, honestly, to be perfectly honest, because he had a hard time finding an agent. And I tried to get him signed with my agency, and they wouldn't sign him. And they took him commercially. And I don't know. I felt bad.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I knew that my dad could, you know, fend for himself. But anyway, so shortly after he got there, I got this job on Broadway, and I left for 2 years. So he moved back to Oklahoma. He was there for a year, and he vowed never to return, and he never did. He just said he just never wanted to set foot anywhere in the state of California again.
Do you think he would have been fully happy for you?
I don't know. I mean, I do. I mean, I know that yes. Well, I'm going to say yes. Of course, I think that most of him would have been fully happy, and I think maybe a little bit of him would have been like, well, can I be a character on Will and Grace?
Right. So he really was an actor.
Yeah. I had a guy that I was friends with from Broadway who was a funny guy who stopped being friends with me because he was so furious that I didn't get him cast as the character of Jack. I was like, I didn't even, the character of Jack was cast before I was. I had nothing to do with
it. I'm still angry with you that I wasn't cast as the character of Jack.
At least you're speaking to me. It's the girl, it isn't the girl.
I want to get back to Karen for a moment, if we can, because it's a character that is so kind of over the top and has so much energy and is kind of vibrating with comedy, I guess, for lack of a better word.
As opposed to me in real life.
Well,
is that what you're
saying? I certainly didn't expect you to come in here all a quiver. I'm thrilled you came at all. Mm. But I'm wondering how you approached playing that character in terms of giving her, or fleshing her out and giving her a real humanity.
Well, I felt that she was very childlike. My secret thing was that I felt like she was very childlike and had a lot of joy. And so I think that can be a fun thing to apply to that kind of character, because I think that character could have been sort of repulsively unlikable. And I think instead she was extremely likable.
I got the results of my physical back and I'm scared to open them. Will you look for me?
Are you afraid they're going to find some blood in your alcohol?
Dear Lord, if I'm okay, I promise I will dedicate the rest of my life to serving you.
It says here you're fine.
Fall for it again, God.
I just think that, like, she's somebody who loves to laugh and can turn on a dime and, you know, extremely emotionally volatile and one, you know, huge extreme of emotion to the other. And that's something that – and I'm not a very analytical person. I never actually studied acting, and if I read a script, I'll just have an instant take on the character, and then it's very hard for me to shake it, I guess, is what I'm saying. Like, if somebody says, well, I don't think that's right, do something else. But I have to go with my gut feeling.
Right, you're stubborn. You're stubborn and undirectable is what that's you're telling me. Was Karen the same in season one as she was in season eight?
No, my God, no. No, I, you know, the whole voice, I didn't do the voice at the beginning because I had had so many, I had gone out on a limb so many times doing these really big characters for things. And sometimes I would get cast and sometimes, you know, I would go to the audition and they'd be like calling security. And... I put a little twist on it. I just made her a little quirkier, I guess. And so that's what they liked, and then they cast me. And then over the first – I didn't consciously decide to do the voice. It just started happening because Will and Grace essentially is farce. Mm-hmm. It's very fast-paced, very kind of – absurdist, you know, it's like a musical comedy without the music. Not new Broadway, but the old good kind. And sorry, new Broadway.
Megan Mullally taking a shot at Broadway. My goodness. Wow.
You know what I mean.
Not a fan of You're in Town here.
No, I love You're in Town. You're in Town.
Not a fan of Book of Mormon.
I love Book of Mormon. No, you don't know what New Broadway is, so I won't bore you with the details.
Megan Mullally taking a shot at me now.
Yes. So because of the pace of the show, I feel like my normal speaking voice, if you hadn't noticed, is a tad laconic. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that really fit with the energy of the show. So over the course of the first 10 episodes or so, that voice and that whole dynamic kind of ramped up by the time we had gotten halfway through the season, I think it was more or less in place.
Did you come to feel a responsibility towards the gay community as a result of that show?
I think so. I think it's safe to say I'm considered a gay icon because of that character. Yeah. And so I do feel a responsibility, and I feel like as the show went on, it started to really hit all of us of the impact that it was having on the gay community, and we would get a lot of letters because this was still sort of pre-email, believe it or not, at the beginning. And we would get letters saying, you know, I was going to kill myself, and then, you know, because my parents wouldn't accept the fact that I was gay, and then my parents started watching Will and Grace, and now they're coming around, and, you know, I mean, really heavy things, and we all started to sort of sit up and take notice of that, and then we were handed a lot of awards by GLAAD and Human Rights Campaign and a lot of other gay organizations.
And you won 2 Emmys for the part.
Yeah.
Something I've always wondered about winning acting awards, and I'm anticipating never having to answer this for myself, but once you win...
Not after I get done with you.
Once you win, and there's this great night, and you've got this trophy, and you're celebrating and being celebrated, what's it like the next day when you wake up and you're an Emmy Award winner? Does it change you? Does that stay with you? Does it feel like anything?
No. I mean, I hate to, nothing against, you know, and now I'll never fucking win another one again.
Megan Mullally taking a shot at the Emmys. Wow. She came loaded for bear today.
I'm just trying to be honest.
No, I want you to be.
Oh, my goodness. You know, first of all, winning that first Emmy is the first award of any kind I've ever won. And I love television, and I've watched television my entire life. And so, you know, the Emmys were a big deal. I mean, I watched the Emmys every year for my whole life. I watched the Tonys every year for my whole life, the Oscars. And so to act, even to be there was crazy. And we came in and I was sitting in the second row on the aisle, and Michael J. Fox was across from me. And my mother was there, like, back in the 18th row or something because, you know, it's really hard to get seats. And I was low man on the totem pole. And it was Chris Rock was presenting. And when he said my name, it was just the most, I don't even know. Like, it's a very weird, surreal thing. And Sean got me in a headlock. I don't know what was happening. And Michael J. Fox was, anyway, I got up there and I made my speech. I actually liked my speech. I did not profusely thank a list of agents and managers and lawyers, which I think is weird and dumb when you have a platform like that for 45 seconds.
Well, you're saying it's dumb to thank them or not to thank them?
Well, I think it's great to have great agents and lawyers and managers, but to spend your whole time in front of millions and millions of people talking about just listing names that nobody else knows, I think is, I don't know. That's just my personal opinion, many of which seem to be very controversial today. But anyway, no, the great thing about winning an Emmy is how excited, like I even said it in my speech, I was standing up there doing my speech and my mother is standing and she's 18 rows back and she's swaying. Her face is all red. She's so excited. That was amazing. I got home. I had a couple of messages on my answering machine because it was 2000. And I had all of my old friends from Oklahoma City that I grew up with are all like screaming like it's like I won, and they're all just like, oh my God! And, you know, that is what's great about it, you know? That's it was incredible. Everybody's so happy, and it's not for you. It's for you, but it's actually just for everybody that you sort of have grown up with and who have supported you and loved you. And, you know, so that part of it is beautiful. But no, I'm not a, you know, Nick and I, neither of us, we don't have any like showbiz memorabilia up on the walls. I mean, people are kind of mortified when I say I keep my Emmys in a closet. But I mean, I think it's, I want to sort of live in the moment, so I don't want to. I don't know. I think if you're the kind of person that if you allow it to sort of change your life in some way or change the way you think about yourself, then that's it. You're screwed. It's over. You know, like once you start believing in all of that stuff, it's over.
That's why I'm so glad I've never won anything. Just because I know I'd be very susceptible to changing.
No, you're so, so real, Michael.
Yeah. Today on How to Be Amazing, we're talking to two-time Emmy Award winner Megan Mullally. In 2003, Megan married actor Nick Offerman. Since then, Offerman's career has followed a very similar trajectory to Megan's. One might even say he's ripping her off. At the age of 39, after years of theater and minor TV roles, just like Megan, he too scored a major Hollywood role. Nick was cast in the role of Ron Swanson, the deadpan, mustachioed libertarian Parks Department director on the hit series Parks and Recreation. In the beginning of your relationship, you were on one of the hottest shows on television, if not the hottest. He was a struggling actor. Was that hard?
No, because of who Nick is, I said at the beginning, I said, look, you know, is this going to be weird for you? Because I'm on this show and it's kind of like it was at its peak, you know, when we were together.
That's how it was with me and Eva Longoria.
God, you too. I'm still bummed that you guys didn't work.
We're still great friends.
I thought, you know what, Megan,
please just respect my privacy during this difficult time. That's all I ask.
Okay, talking about Nick. So no, he didn't. He was very secure with himself. He's very grounded, and he had his woodworking, and he had, you know, he got a wood shop while we were together, and he would go and make furniture every day. And so, you know, in between times, he did work fairly frequently as an actor. I mean, he would get cast in things and do roles, you know, smaller roles in movies and some television work. And he was not threatened.
We have a clip of you and Nick talking about your relationship, which I'm going to play.
All right.
Let's hear it.
We're both sappy. There's a lot of baby talk in our house, too, which I'm
sensing a nickname suddenly.
Oh, well, we...
we just call each other Mom and Pop.
Mom and Pop, yeah. And I call him Papa or Dad or Poppy or...
Or Big Nuts.
Big Nuts. We have a lot of endearments.
You guys are creepy.
Juicy love ringers.
You have a very... public relationship. I mean, in the sense that you're both public people, you don't hide from the press. You're not pulling a Gwyneth and Chris Martin, where you know you seclude yourselves in England and then break up. Was that a choice, or is it just this is who we are and take it or leave it?
Yeah, we'd never really talked about it. I don't think it ever. I think that we never in a trillion years would have expected. I mean, what are the odds? Even though Nick is extravagantly talented, what are the odds of, you know, what, there are two people in one household. I get cast on Will and Grace and this crazy thing happens, and then he gets cast a couple years later on Parks and Rec and the same crazy thing happens. What?
Three to one.
One out of every three people,
yes.
That happens to. All right. I trust your
research. It's uncommon, but it's not unique.
Your research so
no,
far
it happens
has
to one out of three couples.
Quite impressive, so I'm going to have to go with you on this one. Yeah, so just that alone, I think, knocked us slightly off kilter. And it's not that we want everybody to know every detail about our lives. We don't. It's just that, like, whatever manual has been handed out to a lot of celebrities that tell you, like, what to do and what not to do, we didn't get it. We didn't get that manual.
Yeah, I'll give you my copy after
okay,
the
Okay, thanks.
This may be a weird question, but I feel like I would feel this way. Do you feel additional pressure in your relationship because the whole world thinks you're so happy?
Well, you'd think that we would, but we actually do have a really great relationship. So I think that helps to not worry.
I thought you were
going to
say we actually do
it.
Have a really great therapist.
Yeah. No. We don't have a therapist, strangely enough, but we do have a great relationship. I mean, we just really like each other, and so I guess that helps to not worry about I mean, listen, we've said to each other, like, the first time that we ever are in a restaurant and we get into a spat and somebody, like, videotapes it, we're so fucked, you know? But because it's going to happen.
Yeah, you're no longer America's sweethearts.
It's going to happen. It's bound to happen,
sure.
People. Just hear me say that. It's going to happen because we're a married couple. We do, you know, from time to time disagree with each other. But Whatever. I mean, I think that people, because we're both known primarily for comedy, or exclusively for comedy, really, I think that that sort of tempers everything. It's not Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. It's nowhere near that. It's a couple of, you know, people that pull their pants down for a living.
You were married before, and it seemed, I was watching an interview with you where, you know, you said you were initially reluctant to go out with Nick because you said in this kind of worried tone, oh, he's the marrying kind. And it sounded like you didn't want to get married again.
I didn't. I was very staunchly single at the time. I had been single for 4 years, and I was having sort of selective flings here and there, which I thought was fantastic. And I had what I thought was my type, which was a very skinny, androgynous, kind of rock and roll drummer-ish, like B.O. I don't know what my thing was, but that's what I thought my type was, like a muscle-free person who wasn't necessarily qualified as a man.
You're saying I could have been with you.
It's
I stink.
Still not too
I'm
late.
Devoid of muscle.
And so when I first met Nick, he didn't really register. He didn't make the first cut of my, like, sussing out of the cast of the play for who I was going to have my fling with because he had some muscles, and I thought that was gross. And but anyway, we were working together, and in between scenes, I thought he was very funny. We started, like, doing bits together and joking around, and then before you know it, we were kissing.
Mm-hmm. And did you have to make any mental adjustments for yourself going into marriage a second time?
I did not want to get married. I didn't want to get married again.
So why did you?
Well, because he wore me down. No. No, I changed my mind because I fell so deeply in love with Nick. And Nick, I realized that he is such a, you know, he's the person he is. And I love him so much. And so he would do this bit where he would pretend that he was getting ready to propose to me, and he would pull out like a fake ring and then drop it through like a sewer gutter, like a sewer drain or something. And then we would have a big laugh, and then we would just go on with our day. And I don't know how many women would have found that amusing, but I thought it was hilarious. I was glad that it wasn't real. Until when he did propose, then I was really happy. I mean, it just I just needed a little bit of time. He didn't propose. We'd been together for a year and a half before he proposed, so that was a good amount of time.
Tell us about your role as chief in Children's Hospital, which is about to enter its sixth season. You're about to start your sixth?
That seems hard to believe.
And if you're not familiar with it, Children's Hospital is a show on Adult Swim, which was created by Rob Corddry, who plays a kind of Patch Adams character. He's a doctor who wears clown face. And that is pretty much the tone for the entire show. And it's got an amazing cast. Ken Marino and Rob Corddry and Henry Winkler and Lake Bell and you and
Malin Ackerman.
Malin Ackerman. So many great
Aaron
people.
Aaron Hayes.
Oh, Aaron Hayes, who's terrific.
Yeah.
I have not been on the show, even though I know everybody on it. It's not important. That part doesn't matter.
I'm getting you on it. I'm literally not doing it this season unless you're on it.
Look, it's not about ultimatums, but make that happen. We have a clip of the show. This is a clip and I think it's about the fact that staff members at the hospital are often making remarks about their sexual attraction.
All right, next up. It saddens me to have to announce that Dr. Lola Spratt has a brain tumor.
What? You told everyone I have a brain tumor?
You need your friends right now.
I told you that as a lie so that I could break up with you. Okay, listen, everybody. I don't have a brain tumor.
That's right. You don't have a brain tumor.
Yeah, that's what I said.
You don't have a brain tumor.
I know.
Keep saying that, everyone. You don't have a brain tumor.
You don't have a brain tumor.
You don't have a brain tumor. That's your mantra.
You don't have a brain tumor.
You don't have a brain tumor.
All right, people. Next, I want to go over how sick and tired I am of rude waiters. I mean, it's like you're sitting there for 15 minutes and the guy comes over and he's like, can I take your order? Is that annoying or am I crazy?
Oh, God, it's stupid. It's stupid in the best
Hubel.
Possible way.
Dude,
oh, I
love
him.
We mentioned him, but he is amazing.
Yeah.
They all are.
And that show, I mean, nobody's making any money on that show, right? It's basically it's just fun.
It's like a $1 a season.
I assume the Walker and everything. I mean, that was inspired by the chick on whatchamacallit.
Laura Ennis, who I went to college with, who's a friend of mine. And when I first read the scripts, I called her. I was like, dude, you know, would this in any way bother you? She was like, oh, my God, no, it's hilarious. So she loves it. But it started out, in the first season, I had those
polio braces,
yeah. And my little sensitive Irish skin was getting very bruised.
Oh, you poor
dear. I know. I'm very delicate. So we switched over to the Walker. And then we added a hunchback. And I bought that wig on Hollywood Boulevard for $39. It's a man's wig, actually. And then the glasses, our great costume designer found. They're super thick. They're very heavy. It's like wearing a lens from the Hubble telescope on your face. Hurts my nose, like physically hurts me to wear them. She's supposed to be just the grossest person in the universe, but everybody wants to fuck her. I mean, the everybody wants to fuck her part is kind of sort of gone out the window now, but that was originally the conceit.
Mm-hmm.
Now she's just super gross and, you know.
Well, it's a great show. We'll leave it at that. It's really funny.
And oddly enough, has won 2 Emmys.
You just can't keep away from them Emmys. You're an Emmy magnet.
Which was thrilling. For that show to win Emmys was really fun and thrilling.
One thing we have not touched on is your musical career. Aside from theater, you have 2 singing groups. Would that what you would call them, a group? I don't know how rock and roll works.
Yeah, I call it a band.
A band. You've got the Supreme Music Club. Is that still active?
We have not had a show for two or 3 years.
Well, you know, The Who didn't perform for decades.
I know.
But I can still consider them very much a band.
I think that we may still get a booking. But my current concern is called Nancy and Beth, and it's me and this young actress named Stephanie Hunt, actress and musician, and we sing in harmony, and we do choreography, and we do songs from all different eras and genres, and it's very celebratory and fun and funny and dirty, and we do like filthy rap songs.
Yeah, and they're very – the 2 things are very different from each other.
Yes. Supreme Music Program was much more like singing in some cases almost like art songs like Brecht, Weill, you know, and then some more contemporary things like Tom Waits and Randy Newman, but it was much more serious. For the serious music listener. And this is much more lighthearted and festive.
All right. Well, let's listen to Nancy and Beth.
If you just ain't got nobody, since you're gone and lost your head, rigor mortis has set in daddy. Jack, you dead. What's the use of having muscles when your life hangs by a thread? If you ain't got no red, Jack, you dead. You've been always kicking, but you stub your toes when you ups and kicks the bucket, just like old man Moe's.
Are you a trained singer? Did you train?
I tried to take voice lessons, but the guy put me up against the wall and pulled my tongue out with a pair of tongs and wanted me to sing and I was like, you know, this is not my thing. It's not my bag.
Yeah.
I don't really
I had a similar experience at the OBGYN once.
Oh, God. Yeah. Me too. Yeah, so when things become very technical and dissected like that, I just can't do it anymore. I have to do it from my instinct.
Could you always sing?
I always was singing.
Was there music in your house?
My parents had some Barbara Streisand and Judy Garland records because apparently my parents were gay. And when they were out, I would put on, like, I would pick one song and I would put it on and I would just keep playing it over and over and over again until I could sing it exactly like the record. So that's how I learned to sing.
And you also, in an interview, were talking about the discipline that is required for dance. And you were a solo ballerina. Is that what you call it?
Soloist, yeah.
Soloist. And you studied in New York as a teenager?
I did, yeah. I was in a ballet company in Oklahoma City for 5 years, ninth grade through senior year in high school. And I also, 2 summers, I studied at School of American Ballet, which is here in New York. It's in the Juilliard building. It's not part of Juilliard, but it's the New York City Ballet School. And so it's, you know, it's the high, you know, it's the best of the best. And I got great training and crazy discipline and involved in being a ballet dancer, obviously. And it's not for, you know, the faint of heart. And I think that that has translated into everything I've done.
After Will and Grace ended, you jumped immediately into the Megan Mullally Show, which was a daytime talk show.
I know. I've had the craziest fucking career.
Well, how did that come about, and why did it come about?
Well, you know, it came from the right reasons. I mean, what first started it was I got a call during Will and Grace. I got a call from King World, who was Oprah's, you know, company originally. I mean, not her company,
they're
but
her syndicator.
Her syndicator. Yeah. And they wanted to talk to me about doing a talk show. And I've always loved talk shows. Like, I was obsessed with Johnny Carson. I was obsessed with Letterman. I'm obsessed with Conan. I'm obsessed. I've watched talk shows since I was a child. And I've always loved them. I watched Dick Cavett. I watched, you know, all of them. And I've always thought, like, it could be very interesting to host a talk show, but I've always thought nighttime. So when they approached me about daytime, I was like, but I – and then I did I had a couple of concerts at Lincoln Center with that band Supreme Music Program. And Jeff Zucker, who was at that time – the head of NBC, unbeknownst to me, was in the audience, and he comes running backstage after the show and says, "You have to do a talk show. You have to do you have to do a talk show." And I said, "Well, that's funny you should mention it, because I'm talking to King World." And he went crazy, you know, competitive. The competitive thing came out, I think. And I had an offer on the table the next day.
Wow.
And I thought, well, you know what? I'm a big believer in sort of going with the flow. And if the universe was, you know, If two entities were fighting over me to host a daytime talk show, I thought, well, it must be something to it. And so I decided to, and plus, you know, coupled with my love of talk shows, I decided to do it.
And it didn't last. It was on, what, 6 months or so?
Yeah, not even. I think 4.5 or so.
And
we shot, it was something crazy, 83 episodes in 6 weeks or
wow.
Something like that.
Did you enjoy it?
I very much enjoyed the actual interview process. I liked talking to people. I didn't feel a kinship with syndication because it's very much more of a business than it is a creative outlet. And I had all these, I kind of, what I would like to think of as progressive ideas for the show. It's a lot of things that people are doing now that just involving the audience more, like with, you know, interactive stuff was part of some of my ideas. And they wanted to be more like Ellen, and I kept saying over and over again, well, that's fantastic, except Ellen is already doing Ellen.
Right.
So why don't you let me? And she's great at it. So why don't you let me do a different kind of show?
And you were a producer on that show, right?
No, I've never been a producer on anything.
Do you want to be?
Yes! God, yes.
You want to have some control.
You know, I've sold a couple of shows to, like, cable networks, and I would have been producers on those, but they haven't gone. So, but yeah, I would like to be. I've always wanted to produce. I think I'm good at it.
Mm-hmm. Do you write?
I do.
Do you direct?
I have not directed yet, but I would like to direct. I'd like to start out directing a play.
Uh-huh.
I'm a little more interested in that than other mediums.
So when the Megan Mullally show went away, how was that experience?
Well, you know, I feel like if I did it now, I know so much more now. I think I went into it very naively. I didn't know anything about syndication, daytime television. I had not really educated myself properly. I don't know how. I mean, it's just where I was in my life at that time. Maybe I should have done more. But I felt like I did have a lot of really good ideas. They just weren't implemented. But that wasn't why the show didn't go. The show just didn't go because we premiered on the same day as Rachel Ray. Mm. And Rachel Ray got 2.2 million viewers a day, and we got 2. And sometimes 1.9.
You only got 2 viewers?
2. It's
horrible.
Yeah, it was a big disparity. Now that I'm thinking about it. But it actually, when you think about it, it really wasn't that much. Like, say we got 1.9 million and she got 2.2. Right. It wasn't that big of a difference. But at that time, you know, now if you get 0.8, it's like you're, you know, a smash right. in daytime. But everything was different then because it was still, it was 2006.
All right, Megan Mullally, I'm going to wrap things up with you.
No.
This is how we close the show.
All right.
We do something called.
We make out. Quit. God, Michael. Such a weird way. It's radio. I mean, it's a podcast.
I know, but we want it to be very tactile.
Mm-hmm. All right. Wow. Those disturbing sounds.
I don't like when radio hosts say we. I always get distracted when they say we. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say I.
Yeah.
I like to end the show with something called the Amazing Five. I'm going to give you 5 topics. You're going to tell me something amazing. You'll understand. This is the Amazing Five. Give me something that you've seen recently amazing in film. Doesn't even have to be recent. It could be any film.
I'm horrible at this kind of stuff because my whole mind just shuts down.
I know. What's your favorite film? Let's do that.
Well, this year I really liked the movie Her.
Uh-huh.
And
that's this Spike Jonze movie with Joaquin Phoenix. It was nominated for an Academy Award. I've had the screener in my house for 8 months and haven't looked at it.
Oh, it's good.
I know. People love it.
And there was something else that I loved, and now I can't think what it was. So that's my fascinating answer to that question.
Okay, so we have Her and something you loved that you can't think of what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Next, music. What do you love in music right now or ever?
I love Nina Simone.
Sure.
And Tom Waits and Louis Armstrong and Randy Newman. I love bands like The Decemberists and Radiohead and I'm so nervous.
But you're doing great.
Oh my God.
I mean, what's amazing is what the listeners can't see is that you basically shut down as soon as I started asking these questions.
Become like a 7-year-old child.
Yes, your shoulders slumped in, eyes went down, you're fiddling with the headphone cord.
God,
there's no wrong answers.
So much pressure.
And you've given us a lot of great answers so far. What about a book? What are you reading right now?
Oh, I'm reading the best book, The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt.
Look at that. Nailed it.
Well, I'm reading it was reading it last night, so that would be horrible if I couldn't.
Which just won the Nobel or the Pulitzer? It won one of them big awards.
Did it. Oh, it's so good.
Food.
Oh, I love, you know, I just like the all-American. I like hamburgers and mm-hmm. hamburgies and hot doggies.
Right. Throw your ass down into Denny's, you're happy.
I like a pizza.
Yeah.
I like I like a Snickers bar.
Yeah. Yeah. I love these answers.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Gilbert came in here last week. She goes, bone broth. Bone broth?
Gross.
Ew. It's broth you make out of bones.
Oh, my God. My former, my ex-mother-in-law, one time I went to Thanksgiving dinner at their house, and she took a big bone and she cracked it in half and sucked the marrow out. And I've never been so shocked. I mean, she could have like literally bent over and like shown me her anus and I wouldn't have been any more shocked. I couldn't even look over. I was paralyzed.
All right. This last one you're really going to struggle with. Potpourri could be anything.
Something not floral, something woodsy.
It can be floral. No,
cedar.
Cedar. Something in your life right now that you love. And don't say your stupid husband. I don't want to hear about how much you love your husband anymore.
What are you talking about? Potpourri?
I'm not saying like literally potpourri. I'm saying like in Jeopardy, they have the potpourri category, which is anything.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
It could be a piece of clothing. It could be a gadget. It could be a liquid. It could be anything.
Don't yell at me.
Well, now I'm angry.
I'm loving my dream water, which I drink every night before I go to bed.
Is that the water that makes you sleepy?
Oh my gosh, it's luscious.
Is it gin?
It's gin. It's just two large tumblers of gin. No, I actually don't drink alcohol, which is hilarious. It's dream water, and I drink it, and it's tryptophan, GABA, whatever that is, and melatonin, and it's a liquid, and it's quite delightful. Hmm. It knocks me right out.
Very good.
This is embarrassing, but somehow one person mentioned the website Lumosity to me, and I started doing it, and now I'm on a personal quest.
And that improves your brain function.
Yes.
And it clearly helped you a lot in terms of remembering movie names and song names.
Well, I know. It didn't work at all on that, but I've worked my way up into a high percentile, so I'm trying to, get to 100.
Well,
I'm at like 80 something now.
Everybody here is rooting for you.
Thank you.
So we're going to go out on a song by Nancy and Beth. Megan Mullally, I want to thank you so much for being on How to Be Amazing.
Thank you.
You were amazing.
You're amazing. We're kissing really fast.
I'm a really fast kisser.
Wait, let's do slow kissing because that was so fast.
Okay. I might do this when I'm kissing you. I might do this, which would really gross you out. I might do this.
Wait, let's do it one more time.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @HTBA_show. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. How to Be Amazing is mixed and edited by Kristen Clark. Music today from Nancy and Beth and Chad Crouch. I'm Michael Ian Black.
When that happens to you, Daddy, Jack, you dead.